You're tuned to The Weekend, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon. I'm Louis Sines, your host for The Weekend. And joining us today are Drs. Joseph Potter and Carrie White. And they are here to discuss a very interesting research paper that appeared in one of the journals, in this academic journals. And it's the availability and use of postpartum LARC in Mexico and among Hispanics in the United States, and we'll talk about what LARC means in just a minute. But first of all, Dr. Potter and Dr. White, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And let's start with you, Dr. White. Tell us a little bit about your background and what you've been doing there at the University of Texas at Austin.
Sure. My name is Carrie White. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Healthcare Organization and Policy at the School of Public Health at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. And I have been collaborating with Dr. Potter and other researchers at UT Austin for about a decade. And we've been working together on a host of different projects related to women's contraceptive use and access to reproductive health services. And the study that we're going to be talking with you about is one of the products from our research.
And Carrie, I apologize. I mentioned that you were with the University of Texas at Austin. I meant to say you were working in conjunction with them, but thank you for correcting that.
Sure, no problem.
And Dr. Potter?
Hi, my name's Joe Potter. I'm a demographer at the University of Texas, and I've been working with Carrie for these many years, doing some work in El Paso and now more recently focused on the whole state of Texas and reproductive health policy. This paper actually is fun for me because it goes back to the early days of my career when I was living in Mexico and working on these same issues with the National Family Planning Program there while a researcher at El Colegio de Mexico. So the paper is really about a comparison of what went on in Mexico and what is now going on in the United States. And so that's kind of where it comes from.
We are visiting with professors Dr. Joseph Potter and Dr. Carrie White, discussing their paper, The Availability and Use of Postpartum Long-Acting Reversible Contraception, or LARC, in Mexico and among Hispanics in the United States. Now, in reading this paper, one of the things that you all mentioned is the fact that this study, regardless of what was done, is not that well-known or not well talked about.
Well, what's not well known in the United States is the experience of Mexico, particularly with immediate postpartum IUDs, which goes back to the 1980s. And Mexico is really the pioneer in terms of the whole world in immediate postpartum use of long-acting contraception. And one of the things we do in this paper is follow the evolution or the use of postpartum contraception in Mexico over that whole sweep of period from 1987 through to the present. That's a big part of it. Postpartum LARC is becoming a focus in the United States, but it's something that's very recent. So people in the U.S. by and large don't know what's going on in Mexico. Conversely, people in Mexico can't imagine what's going on in the United States. Even people directly across the border, and I once gave a talk in Autónoma de Ciudad Juárez, and so there is this kind of disconnect between the experience of the two countries.
Now, as you mentioned, the study, and between 1987 and I think it was 2014, you mentioned that postpartum LARC use in Mexico doubled, increasing from 9 to 19% immediately postpartum and from 13 to 26% by 18 months following delivery, while in the U.S. it was less than 0.1% of women who used an IUD or implant immediately following delivery. And let me see, where is this? And 9% used one of these methods in 18 months.
Yeah.
Would you care to comment on any of that, maybe, Carrie?
Sure. I think, unlike Mexico, the experience with the IUD in the United States has been very different, and it had a darker history in the United States with respect to certain types of IUDs being taken off the market and having a very negative reputation with both women and clinicians. And with a new generation of IUDs and even contraceptive implants becoming available in the 2000s, these methods have become more popular among women and also more well received by providers. It's just taken some time for interest in these to catch on. Now that there is a greater interest in use of these methods, there are steps that are being taken to try to increase women's access to getting these methods, particularly at a time following a delivery when women are very motivated to prevent another pregnancy. And so some of the changes that we have been seeing in a select few states in the U.S. is that states are making changes, for example, to their Medicaid policy to allow for hospitals and clinicians to be reimbursed for providing these methods in the hospital following delivery before a woman gets discharged home. So this is a really recent change and something one of the reasons why we see such limited use of these methods in the U.S., at least in the data that we have.
Is there a difference in the use? Maybe, perhaps, some people might wonder, well, in Mexico, it's the government, it's a government program, and they're pushing for this, while in the United States, it may be pretty much, up to the individual, yet they still may face some of those, that red tape that the insurance company puts up.
Yeah, it's more than red tape in the sense that there was a structural disincentive in the way that deliveries were paid for with one single fee. That's another huge thing, is the difference in the cost of an IUD between Mexico and the United States. The Mexican National Family Program pays a far smaller price for, say, a copper T IUD than does any hospital in the United States. But that being said, the incentives prior to the rule changes were such that it was almost impossible to provide immediate postpartum LARC unless you had some other source of funding besides Medicaid. So that rule change was important. I think the other point that, was implicit in what Carrie's saying is that lots of practitioners, lots of clinicians in the United States aren't familiar with IUDs and implants, don't necessarily believe in their effectiveness and safety, and in particular are not practiced or trained with respect to postpartum insertion. So you have kind of blocks on the provider side. Without the rule change, you have financial disincentives for providers to supply this service. And to say that it's up to the woman, of course, it is up to the woman in both cases. But I think one of the interesting points about this paper is a large fraction of the public patients in Texas or California and quite a few other states are people who either grew up in Mexico, were born in Mexico, or have family and relatives in Mexico. So for them, postpartum IUDs is an extremely normal, we have this interview in the paper where they're pretty much shocked to find out how hard it is to get an IUD in the U.S. immediately postpartum, but even afterwards. So that's part of the contrast.
And I just want to add on to that, that one of the other things that we report on in this study is that there are, although there's a very limited use of IUDs and implants immediately following delivery, what we're showing is that there are a lot of Mexican origin women in our study who really had an interest in using these methods. So the limited use is not necessarily reflective of women's interest, but really demonstrates the various administrative and structural challenges that women have to getting the method that they want to use in the United States.
We're visiting with Professors Carrie White and also Joe Potter, and we are discussing the availability and use of postpartum long-acting reversible contraception, or LARC, in Mexico and among Hispanics in the United States. In discussing this, in part of the paper, you also mentioned how in 1973, under the administration of Luis Echeverria, that Mexico adopted a policy to promote family planning and to guarantee its citizens a right to decide freely on the number and spacing of their children. And in fact, this policy was embedded in the national constitution and institutionalized in a national population council, or Consejo Nacional de Población. Can you tell us a little bit about this and perhaps how this may have influenced also the ability for more Mexican women to have IUDs?
Sure. And it is a big contrast with the United States, which doesn't have a national policy. So I think another important thing to mention is the difference between kind of the structure of the two governments. Mexico at the time was a quite centralized operation or system. So if the president and the Congress decide something, they can pretty much make it happen by sending out rules or programs. So they were able to mount a training program that reached a large fraction of the people who were providing delivery services throughout the public sector hospitals in Mexico in a way that's quite different from what could happen in the United States. So there was a program, there was public information that went along with this program, advertising. You could see signs throughout Mexico. So there was a kind of publicity and awareness about family planning throughout the country that is quite different from the situation in the U.S.
So let's talk now about, because your paper also goes on to mention the study, postpartum contraception in Texas in 2012, and two of the cities involved in the study are Austin and El Paso. Carrie, you or Joe can talk about this?
We had decided to launch the study in these two cities for a couple of reasons. As Joe mentioned earlier in the conversation, our team had been doing work for several years in El Paso on women's access to oral contraception specifically, as well as other methods of contraception. And what we knew about, one, we had a lot of contacts in the area, and we knew that we could be successful doing another study in El Paso. But also, given our experience working there and some of the major changes that had taken place with family planning program funding in Texas, we knew that we would be encountering a very different service environment in El Paso as compared to Austin, where much of the team is based. And so we thought that selecting these two cities would help us identify or potentially identify any potential differences in access. I don't know, Joe, if you want to add anything else to that.
No, that's good.
So what about the fact that, and you know, I may be just perhaps saying this because I live here in the El Paso area. We have a lot more Spanish speakers than Austin does. Is that fair to say?
It is fair, but amongst the public patients in Austin, there's a high percentage of Spanish speakers. It's not as high as El Paso, but it's still quite high.
So I was wondering if that had any effect at all on the study, because I know you said you did it in English and in Spanish.
Sure. No, the whole thing is bilingual. There were a higher fraction doing the interviews in Spanish in El Paso than in English, but all the interviewers were bilingual.
Just out of curiosity, I'm wondering when the study in Mexico was done, did the governments or people run into any pitfalls or red tape regarding the Catholic Church?
Well, that's a long story. But in fact, the opposition back in the late 70s and early 80s from the Catholic Church was quite minor. There was the occasional bishop who would give a sermon or a speech or something. But one of the things that I discovered, or well known, but that I personally discovered doing field work in rural Mexico, was that priests are few and far between. You go to a small rural village in most parts of Mexico, they might see a priest every couple of months who would rotate through there. But the Catholic Church isn't as large a presence in terms of face-to-face encounters as you might expect. The second part is that not all people in the Catholic Church were against family planning or birth control. So that's another part. And you had the separation between church and state that has become perhaps less marked than it was back in those years with the pawn and so forth. I am shocked. Well, put it this way. I am surprised by the influence that the Catholic Church has in Texas relative to what it has in Mexico. The Catholic Church is a factor in what happens in Texas in different instances. I would say more so than it ever was in Mexico.
Wow, I'm surprised at that too. I mean, that took me by surprise. I would just think that Mexico, with the rich history of the Catholic Church being there, that perhaps it would be the other way around. But thank you for sharing that with us.
Well, I'm not an observer.
Yes, not an official study. I understand. So let's talk a little bit about the case study on postpartum contraceptive preferences, because as we all know, there are many preferences out there, and some people may find it easier to have an IUD. Some people may say, well, I'd rather take a pill. Some other people might say, well, I forget to take a pill, so I think the other thing is way is better. What did you all find among these people?
Well, what we found among the women that we interviewed in both El Paso and Austin was that a very large percentage of them, almost half, would prefer to be using an IUD or implant following delivery for contraception. And another large percentage would like to have their tubes tied or be using female sterilization. There is a much smaller percentage of women who indicated that they wanted to use a method like the pill or an injectable contraceptive method like Depo-Provera. Despite the fact that women had a preference for these methods, as we've mentioned before, most women were using methods that were less effective than the ones they wanted to use. And some women were not using a method of contraception at all, despite having a preference for using something.
And in the pie charts that you have here in the paper as well, it's very interesting to see the pie graph and how it goes out, especially when you're talking about sterilization, which you mentioned a little while ago. And in Austin, it's 33%, in El Paso, 15%. Those are interesting numbers.
There's a wrinkle to that.
Okay.
Is a little bit complicated to explain. There's certainly a large unmet demand for female sterilization in El Paso, particularly in the UMC, or what used to be Thomason. It's a question of funding. It's a question of who's eligible and so forth. There are lots of reasons why that's blocked. The numbers for Austin are a little bit not comparable, in the sense that, funnily enough, one of the largest hospital systems in Austin is Catholic, Seton, which is part of Ascension Healthcare. And so they don't provide a postpartum female sterilization. And so we did this survey in another hospital. So you've got kind of a selection effect of people who are planning to get a sterilization in the Austin hospital, which you don't have in El Paso, that doesn't take away from the results of this paper and other papers that we've done that point to a large demand for sterilization in El Paso, that the providers, not through lack of interest, but through lack of resources and administrative constraints, are unable, are not in a position to be able to meet.
One of the things that you mentioned in your paper, and this is on the side of the participants and some of the patients, and the fact that, you know, a lot of people, whatever it is, whether it be birth control, whether it be contraceptive, whatever, some of the things that they look upon are the side effects, and sometimes they just don't want to deal with the side effects.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true, and you know, that is one important factor that women consider about the method that they choose. But, you know, one of the things about the long-acting reversible contraceptive methods is that, you know, they have a favorable profile of side effects, meaning that there are, you know, most women can use these methods without experiencing many problems, and that's some of the reasons that women like them and want to use them.
Carrie, is there, and Joe, have you guys found anything while doing your research that perhaps points to a different kind of study or where other methods are being used where it's not the female but the male who is being asked to, you know, get a vasectomy or whatever else he may need to do, so that the woman perhaps wouldn't have to do that if she may be in ill health or she may not just want to do it?
Well, that is a really great question, and it's something that we have been looking at in Texas, actually, as a part of our work. And one of the things that we have found is that while women have interest in using methods that they cannot get, like IUDs, implants, and sometimes female sterilization, what we found is that there are very few providers, particularly serving low-income populations, that are even offering vasectomy as a service to their family planning clients. They have limited funding to be able to conduct any outreach and education around the method, and even less money to be able to provide the method to any men who may be interested in it. It's a great option for couples who have decided that they do not want more children. It's cheaper than female sterilization. It's more effective than female sterilization. And the recovery is easier for a man versus a woman. But it's certainly a method that just is not widely available in the state of Texas.
Is this something, Carrie, that perhaps in your research you found that is very different from other parts of the world, and also that some of it might be a cultural thing where the man doesn't want to go through something like this?
Well, I think that the perception that men just aren't interested in vasectomy, there certainly is, there are some men who hold those attitudes, but some other work that Joe Thalia Hubert, who's also a co-author on this paper, and I have done, was specifically around vasectomy among Latino male partners in El Paso. And what we found is that these men that we did focus groups with, some of them, they certainly did have some attitudes that, you know, female sterilization could be a better method for women or for a couple who didn't want to have more children. But by and large, we did hear men express the concern that, you know, sometimes their female partners had had a difficult pregnancy, women had been responsible for using contraception throughout the course of their relationship, and it was really time for them to take their turn at being responsible for preventing future pregnancies. And they also expressed lack of knowledge about where one could go in El Paso to get a vasectomy done. And some of the men who knew about vasectomy, they knew it because one of their friends or their brother had crossed over into Mexico and been able to get the procedure there. So again, kind of demonstrating this more constrained access to the service in the U.S. context than may be the case in Mexico.
And in both instances, would insurance be a big concern as well?
Well, to the extent that, I mean, insurance, some insurance plans do cover vasectomy. The challenge with for lower income populations in Texas, and this would go for women as well, is that if you are someone who is in the United States and are not documented, your options for insurance are pretty limited, and you're often relying on county indigent care programs or some other kind of subsidized funding for this type of service, which is, while still inexpensive compared to delivery, somewhat costly. So that really limits the options. And then, again, even for those who do have Medicaid, there are very few providers who will accept that form of payment who do vasectomy services.
Who charge the reimbursement is about a quarter of what a urologist in private practice in El Paso would charge. So to develop, it's a simple procedure, and you could certainly make an argument that the $250 or whatever it is that Medicaid reimburses is enough, but you've got to train people and put them up in a situation where they don't have a large amount of overhead in order to make that work, which is something that, you know, for the most part, doesn't happen. And when it does happen, it, as in one case in El Paso, it may be short-lived.
Dr. Potter and Dr. White, we have about 30 seconds left in the program. If you wouldn't mind, if someone were to ask you about this article or this paper that you've written, how would you sum it up?
I guess. Well, I think the most important thing is just to compare Mexico and the U.S. We're talking about immediate postpartum contraception. This is something that's been going on for a long time in Mexico, and it's something that's brand new in the U.S. I think the bottom line is that there are lessons here. It would be good for providers and others in the U.S. to have greater familiarity with what's happening in Mexico, in part because it shapes or it has an influence on the demand for services. The other thing is it is an example of how it can be done. Of course, it's not an obvious. They're two very different healthcare systems, but the lack of communication between the two, I think it will be great if we could move past that and have greater awareness of what's going on in both systems.
Well, Dr. Potter, thank you so much for being with us. And Dr. Carrie White and Dr. Joseph Potter, they've been with us discussing the availability and use of postpartum long-acting reversible contraception in Mexico and among Hispanics in the United States. Dr. Potter and Dr. White, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
The Weekend is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Felipe Talavera. Our producer is Lauren Terrazas. You've been tuned to The Weekend. I'm Luis Sainz.